I'm Herb Wally. I'm from the Larry Durker chapter, and we're getting ready to hear from Richard Thurston about the strike zone squeeze. And so please silence all your devices and provide your attention, and we'll have Q&A hopefully in about 20 minutes. Thank you.
When I was at the luncheon yesterday, I had Larry Durker sign my registration card. So now if I turn this over, I'm Larry Durker. We were actually born the same month, the same year. I've been living in the late 1940s for the last several months, and I think we can have some fun with the strike zone squeeze. Three men who were arguably the face of baseball for the previous 30 years were all passing away as America marched into a new post-war era. Commissioner Landis, November of 1944. Johnson, Walter Johnson, December of 1946. And the Babe in August of 1948. Change was a fact of life in post-war America. When the war ended, there were some other changes that were specific to baseball. For instance, it wasn't just last year's major leaguers and the minor league standouts of the current year who came to spring training to look for a roster spot. It was the men coming back from military service, and increasingly during this period, men with Negro League background. Attendance went way up, that was in part due to another unusual set of circumstances. Wide open pennant races were common. It seemed like everybody had a chance to win. Look at this. From 1944 to 1948, there were four different teams that won National League pennants and five different teams that won American League pennants. That latter fact only happened that one time in the 60 years that the American League was an 8-team league. One other difference is the focus of this presentation. For more than 100 years, the number of walks per game per team has been in the 3-4 range, except for that 1 3-year period, 1948-1950, and in the AL only, that jumped to 4-4.5. And as you can see from this graph, suddenly at the war's end, walks per game in the American League only accelerated, and for three consecutive years it was very high, and then it quickly fell back down. You can see Mount Everest there to the left center of your screen. It ramped up from the mid-40s. The lowest point is 1944. It went up steadily for several years after that. And even more remarkably, it didn't happen in the other league. National League to this point had produced fewer walks per game anyway, and it wasn't affected at all. So you see here, no spike, spike, no spike, spike. Just how statistically significant is that spike? Well, it looks pretty statistically significant to me. You can see the standard deviation from the mean of those three seasons. It's different from anything that either league has seen during the last 100 years. In table form, here's how the walks changed season by season during the years 1945 to 1953. On the right, you can see how the numbers build steadily from 1945 on, and they really explode in 1948. Notice the totals are above 5,000 in each of our three focus years, 48 through 50. Peak season was 49, with a significant drop-off beginning in 1951. All right. Once any baseball fan hears about this, immediately they'll have a theory, or two, or several. And I know that every one of you, whether you'd ever heard about this phenomenon before today or not, has already figured out several things that could cause it. Probably the most common one is that some specific outlier pitchers caused it. Guys came into the league who walked the whole ballpark. And if you know anything about this era, you probably immediately think about Tommy Byrne. He holds the all-time record for the most walks allowed in a single game, 16. Second place is 13. One of the co-holders of that record is none other than Tommy Byrne. He did it 6 days after he walked 16 in a single game. Maybe it's some specific outlier batters, and of course, two of the names that come to mind in that era. Ted Williams, who drew walks at a higher rate than even Babe Ruth, believe it or not, and Eddie Yost. Growing up in Washington, D.C., going to games at Griffith Stadium, it seemed like every game started with Eddie Yost on first base after a walk. They called him the walking man. Maybe it was something in the front office or on-the-field leadership. Guys like Boston Red Sox manager Joe McCarthy, Indians owner Bill Vack, maybe some other smart guys who, in effect, learned the lessons of Moneyball decades before the book was written. Namely, that in many cases, a walk really is as good as a hit. Maybe they were the guys who looked for more patient hitters or trained the hitters they had to be more patient. Or maybe it had something to do with the war itself. Here's a staged photo of Joe DiMaggio in his wartime years. Joe was glad to get back to baseball afterwards, and he and a lot of other hitters were determined to make up for lost time after the war was over. And in fact, the average age of AL hitters was historically high throughout the late 1940s. On the other hand, the war seemed to deprive a lot of young pitchers of the training that seems to be necessary to teach control. And if you think about it, there were very few top-notch pitchers who were developed in the immediate post-war years, especially in the American League. Or maybe it was something else, some tangible change in the basics of baseball, playing conditions or equipment or something else. What I wanted to know is this. Is there a way to evaluate these theories statistically? Now, Bill James, Steve Treader, and several others have touched on this, different things over the last many years, but I've spent the last year looking for some kind of thorough statistical analysis for it. If it's out there, it's pretty well hidden because I couldn't find it. And I'm an accountant by trade, and I want to account for things with numbers. So here's how I went about it. Two things. I wanted to isolate and compile individual performances by season and determine the impact that each had on total league walks, and then I wanted to look for any other meaningful correlations I could find and quantify them if possible. To start out with, here's a number that should be easy to remember as we continue. If you start with a good conservative baseline, drawing a line from the walks in AL in 47 to the walks in AL in 51, and just seeing what's above that, the spike consists of just over 2,000 walks, as near as I could tell. Extra walks for those three seasons. So that's the target for our analysis. We want to account for those 2,000 walks. We want to know who or what was responsible for the increase. In order to do this, I needed a new metric. So here's what I came up with. Voila. Introducing Voila. Easy to remember, WALA walks above league average. And as you'll see in a moment, you can also use that for PWALA, pitchers walks above league average, or HWALA, hitters walks above league average. Now, I'm not a statistician by trade, so this really is not that complicated. Here's how it works. Suppose you want to find out what the league would be like if Tommy Byrne, with his 196 innings and 179 walks in the year 1949 in the American League, what would it be like without Tommy Byrne? Well, to do that, I backed out those walks and innings and calculated the walks per innings of the league without Tommy Byrne. And then I came up with a league average pitcher, put him back in, gave him 196 innings, and on my calculations, he would walk 99.4 batters. So the difference between 179 and 99.4, 79.6. That is, in effect, Tommy Byrne's PWALA for the year 1949. And incidentally, it is one of the highest in history. On the other side, I used plate appearances rather than innings pitched. So take out Ted Williams, his 730 plate appearances, 162 walks, calculate lead average, put back in league average without Williams, batter, and he, I figured, would draw 84 walks, so the difference between 162, 84, 78, and that's Ted Williams' 1941 HWALA. In effect, again, that's one of the highest in league history. Here's one other important point that we need to get straight before we go along. Let me ask you, in a garden variety walk, if you had to split the responsibility for that walk between the hitter and the pitcher, what kind of a ratio would you use? I'll give you a second to be thinking about that. I've asked that question over the last year to a lot of knowledgeable baseball fans. I've gotten a wide range of answers. Anything from the area of 80% pitcher to 20% hitter to the other extreme, 20% pitcher, 80% hitter. And I know there's not one right answer. And I know it varies widely from situation to situation. But for purposes of this project, I had to come up with some ratio, and I'll get to why in just a moment. I came up with 50-50. Not perfect, but as it turns out, as I did the analysis, it really doesn't matter. I don't think that the results would be changed much if I went 60-40 up to 40-60, or even a little bit outside that. Because the point is, I had to do some kind of adjustment because of this. One P-walla plus one H-walla still equals only one walk. If Tommy Byrne walks Ted Williams, as I think happened three times in 1949, each walk adds one to Tommy Byrne's total. It also adds one to Ted Williams' total, but it only adds one to the league walk total. So after adjustments, here's what happens. Tommy Byrne leads the list of the guys who accounted for the most of the increases in, or for the most increase per pitcher in league walks. And then the other names are probably not that familiar to you for obvious reasons. They walked a lot of guys and didn't stick around a long time in some cases. Now, I figured these guys, between them, for those 3 years, added about 300 walks to the league total. Of course, there are other outliers at the other extreme. Guys like Fred Hutchinson, who was mentioned recently, Eddie Lopat, guys who were extreme control pitchers. In fact, many of them had what I would call negative PWALA. But throughout this process, I'm just trying to find out the guys who push the needle towards the increase in walks. And so here's a pie chart. Those nearly 300 walks would be about 14% of the walks that we're trying to account for. So those six guys, I calculated, would be responsible for about 14, accounting for 14% of the increase. You can do the same thing for hitters. These are some more familiar names. Ted Williams at the top, Johnny Pesky, his Red Sox teammate, at the bottom, Eddie Yost, somewhere in the middle, and then three members of the Philadelphia A's, of all things. Those six guys together, they were the leaders in the highest adjusted H-walla for the three-year period. And together, I figured that they accounted for nearly 400 of the spike in walks. And on a pie chart, updated pie chart, looks like this. Also wanted to look at pitchers per team and hitters per team to see if that was some influence of the kind of training the managers, guys that the GMs had assembled and so forth had something to do. And I backed out the outliers, that is Williams and Pesky and Tommy Byrne, the guys that we'd already accounted for earlier, and I came up with this. There were three pitching staffs that gave up a lot of walks, the A's, the Browns, and the A's, the Browns, and the White Sox, and two squads of hitters, the Tigers, and even without Williams and Pesky, the Red Sox. Evidently, Joe McCarthy really was able to teach his hitters how to draw more walks. So those groups together added 180 so walks, or about 9% of the total. And then this is a little harder, but not impossible. I wanted to account for the effect of those new players coming into the league, and so I used this WALA calculations to see what would it be like if certain players went out every year, others came in, and so I used the replacements and calculated how much a difference they made compared to the people they replaced. And in fact, as you can see, the new pitchers each year added a good bit. Again, I've backed out the outliers that we've already accounted for. But what was left, those new pitchers added almost 200 walks on their own, and then the new hitters added about another 100. Together, almost 300. So here's the updated pie chart one more time. There's one other thing that was mentioned as a theory, and I really wanted to do some kind of statistical analysis on this, but when I got into it, I realized there wasn't a whole lot to analyze. There weren't many physical changes in the game of baseball. In this most tumultuous time, one of the most tumultuous times in Major League history, there weren't a lot of rule changes, there weren't a lot of equipment changes, no new stadiums were built. The ball changed, you know, they got better rubber, and the ball got better, but it was more consistent. There's nothing in the change of the ball that I could see would lead to more walks. If anything, you'd think the pitchers would have better control. So I really couldn't do much in that thing, but there was one other significant thing that did change, and we've already talked about it, and that was the disparity between the number of walks, or the rate of walks in the American League and the rate of walks in the National League. So I wanted to answer this question. How could this happen only in one league? Today we've got continual interleague play, and it's really tough to imagine or in some cases remember just how distinct the two leagues were in this period and the years before that. Long before the DH rule came along, the two leagues really existed in parallel universes. Each one had its own distinct culture. And although they started out as the upstart challenger to the much older National League, the AL soon took on the characteristics and the clout of a big brother. Here's how it played out. NL had the longer history, but the AL had the upper hand in almost every other department. With stars like Cobb and Johnson and Ruth and Grove and Greenberg and Feller and DiMaggio and Williams, they were the perennial favorites. World Series, All-Star Games. And it was perhaps no coincidence that their league president wielded more authority than his National League counterpart. That extended to authority over umpires also. As far back as Casey is the bat, we're familiar with the phrase, kill the umpire. But umpire's lot wasn't made much better by the way that the Major League treated the men in blue. They substantially underpaid them, and they otherwise overlooked them, and umpires, in fact, had very little leverage in a game that depended so completely on their integrity. Especially in the American League in this era, umpires were expected to keep a low profile, do what they were told, and not rock the boat. Take just a second and ask you to think of all, if I were to ask you to think next minute or two, all the pre-World War II umpires that you could name, unless you're an umpire specialist, I'm going to suggest that almost all those names are going to be NL umpires. That's where the charisma was. That's where the flamboyance was. The AL wanted quiet, dignified, faceless men. They didn't want a Bill Clem who called attention to himself or seemed to. Here's an incident that shows just how badly umpires could be treated. Happy Chandler came in to succeed Landis as commissioner, and in his first year, he talked to Ernie Stewart, who was one of the bright young AL umpires. He asked Stewart to go around to his colleagues, identify some things that could be improved about their working conditions. Will Herridge was the AL president. Will Herridge got wind of this. He was furious. He thought it was the first step towards organizing an umpires union. He didn't care who had started it. He got Ernie Stewart into his office and Happy Chandler and forced Stewart to resign. Happy Chandler, the commissioner of baseball, and Ernie Stewart, one of the bright young umpires, are no match for Will Herridge. With a maximum of four sites hosting a game on any given day, that meant only 12 umpires were needed, and there wasn't much turnover during this period. Each umpire was typically calling balls and strikes for about 8% of all the games in the league. And so, if just a handful of individuals changed their approach to the strike zone, it could greatly affect the frequency of walks. Wouldn't that be unfair? Well, if an umpire was favoring one team over another consistently, yes, that would be unfair. But if you're simply saying that umpires call different strikes in different times or different places, that happens all the time, right? Now, several people have pointed out that the AL practice was the umpires would wear the balloon chest protector outside their suit coats, And this would force them to stand looking down over the catcher's head and not crouching very much. NL umpires like Bill Clem here, they wore the chest protector underneath the coats. They would crouch, look over the catcher's shoulder in that format. That meant typically AL umpires called the high strike, NL umpires called the low strike. But even aside from that, strike zones have always differed from umpire to umpire, situation to situations. There are hitters with a good eye and pitchers who can paint the corners, and they get the benefit of the doubt. And we're seeing this more and more as FX and similar technologies have come to the fore. It's actually being shown up. Of course, now we're talking a lot about the value of catchers framing pitches and that sort of thing. The good folks at RetroSheet have now given us the opportunity to track who was behind the plate during these years, and so I was able to look and see if there were umpires who were consistently hitters umpires or consistently pitchers umpires, and I actually found only one man who was consistently a hitters umpire, and that was Eddie Hurley. I calculated all by himself that Hurley was responsible for adding nearly 140 walks to the American League total, or 7%. And so that leaves us this. One last piece of the puzzle. Here's the men and one woman who were in charge of the American League teams during those years. When it came to this historic change in the number of walks, the team owners were the dogs that didn't bark. If they had wanted to stop this, I believe they could have. They stopped or delayed a lot of other things, but they didn't, and that has to be significant in some way. I can't prove this statistically or otherwise, but here's what I think happened. Four main revenue streams for major league teams in this era: tickets, broadcasting rights, concessions, and advertising. And in each case, the longer the game, the better this worked. The longer the game, the more offense there was. The longer the game, the more walks there were. The more offense there was, the longer the game. I don't know that happened, but I do know that game times did creep up consistently during the post-war years, especially in the American League. By 1951, imagine, games were averaging almost 2 hours and 21 minutes long. Here's a couple of gentlemen who have played a role in this. You've already met Will Herridge on the left. The man on the right is Tommy Connolly. He umpired the very first American League game in 1901 all by himself. He remained active as an umpire for 30 years, and then he had 23 years as the league supervisor of umpires. He was well respected. In his later years, he was rarely challenged. He was one of the first two umpires who went into the Hall of Fame. The idea of a quiet word from either or both of these two men, to the effect that fans aren't going to come out to see low-scoring games, and that the league needed more offense, and that maybe the size of the strike zone might factor into that equation prudently, that doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility to me. Everybody wants to know why'd it end. Here's a couple of suggestions. Yankees came along. Remember the five seasons with the five different pennant winners I was talking about? 49 to 53, everybody knows what happens. Offense had reached acceptable levels without a walk. The walk is probably the dullest play in baseball. If you can juice up the offense not using walks, if you could bring up a young kid from Commerce, Oklahoma named Mickey Mantle in 1951, you know, that's a better solution. Television was coming on the fore, and baseball had to be more conscious, especially of how bad the umpires' calls were. So that may have had something to do with it. And owners had other things on their mind. They were dealing with franchise relocation and what to do about integration. And in 1951, the Congress started hearings on the reserve clause. And of course, Ted Williams went off to be a fighter pilot in Korea. And when he did, in 52 and 53, he took his 150 walks per year with him. So, like David Smith before me, I'm left with a big question mark at the end of the talk. If the outliers had produced enough to account for this, I'd be able to tell you where those 2,000 walks came from. Without them, there's still a hole. More than a third of these walks that I can't account for. Maybe you can. But I do know that if the outliers don't provide a complete explanation, the baseline must have moved. And what I've ended with is my best speculation as to what moved that baseline. Thank you for your attention.